we're starting the spooky season early with a treat, not a trick. Author, screenwriter, journalist, and hauntingly handsome guy Grady Hendrix chats about his work, including Horror Store, My Best Friend's Exorcism, We Sold Our Souls, The Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires, and The Final Girls Support Group. Join us for a scarily good time on Uncensored Radio.
Hey, out there in UCR land, we have a very special show for you today. We're going to start the spooky season a little bit early. It is all treat and no trick, because today with us, we have an author, a journalist, a screenwriter, and all things amazing, according to his own website. Today, we have joining us Mr. Grady Hendrix. Hello, Grady. How are you?
You left off gentleman and scholar.
I'm sorry.
I'm disappointed.
Oh, well, look. We can only hope to disappoint you further.
I don't wear all this makeup for, like, no reason.
Oh, we love makeup. We've all got makeup on this morning.
No one said anything about how pretty I am.
Thank you. That was my favorite line in your whole bio. Was like, he's very pretty and he doesn't mind being told or whatever. Like,
who does? When you've got all this going on, it's only natural that people are going
to
mention it.
Look, Freddie, your eyes are popping today. Beautiful. Yeah,
thank you. I do a little bit of white eyeshadow right in the corners there and there. I use some V serum just to keep the wrinkles out. And boom. It's like two searchlights.
How's your contouring skills going?
You know what? Naturally occurring. I don't contour the artificial way. If I really need to tighten up this instrument, I stand under a very cold waterfall for like 12 hours and just makes it taut.
Yeah, makes sense.
Brings out the cheekbones.
I find like a bit of body shock. Baby stem cells work the best, as everybody said Ellen was using.
Yeah.
Let's kill all the children and just be youthful forever.
It's gonna be one of those shows, I think.
I always say it's not a snack platter without baby stem cells.
Exactly.
Remember how you always talked about getting cancelled, Jeffrey? This could be the one.
This could be it.
I've been trying.
You know, babies aren't online. They're not on social media. Soft target.
Yeah, too easy. All right, so I'm going to jump straight into it with one of the craziest things that I've read in your whole bio. Mm. You worked for the Society of Cyclical Research?
Yes.
Tell me more.
So I basically, this was late 90s, I guess, early 2000s. And it was just a Craigslist ad for an office manager for a nonprofit. And so I go up, and the nonprofit turned out to be the ASPR, the American Society for Psychical Research, because psychical sounds more serious than psychic. And they've been around since 1885. William James was one of the founders, Henry James's brother. And they were basically founded to investigate parapsychology, because that was sort of the big spiritualism boom and all that. And they wanted to apply scientific reasoning to that. And so they had this townhouse on the Upper West Side and this great archive. And I was kind of they were sort of like between sort of phases in their existence. So I really like was kind of the only employee at the time. And I sat in this townhouse and answered the phone. And interestingly enough, Dan Aykroyd and his brother, it was dad too, but were members. And Dan, this is the place that Dan based the original Ghostbusters script on, because it was originally sort of a more serious script. But you know, the woman who screams, "We got a ghost," she's actually based on the person who had my job, I think three or four people before I had it. So yeah, I was there for 4 years, maybe five, and read a lot of material in the archive and answered the phone a lot.
And did you ever see the ghost? Exciting. Is that the woman screaming?
No, you know, we had a lot of people calling in who'd seen ghosts. And it's interesting, you know, it's I really felt like it's the thing I learned is seeing a ghost is a pretty common human experience. Like, I would be hard pressed to, you know, I think probably most people feel like they've seen a ghost or something they processed as a ghost. And I think it's really interesting to see it on their level, like not be like, oh, it was a reflection of it. You know, it's like, well, why? You know, what did that mean to you? You know, I usually would ask people a lot of questions, and that would sometimes help them zero in on what was going on in their life. But it was really interesting. People processed a lot of trauma, a lot of grief, a lot of like sort of life disruption through seeing ghosts and supernatural events. It was really cool. And seeing the archive, which went back to the 18th century, like you'd read accounts of things then, you know, 1810, 1820, that were really close to what people were calling in and reporting now. And so I think a lot of times this stuff fits into a framework that's cultural, you know, and a lot of times maybe it's working on the same apparatuses in the brain. So yeah, it was really fascinating. I love doing it. It was a great job.
It sounds that's, like a great job.
That's amazing.
But no, I was just going to say, and then every now and then you get someone calling in with, you know, oh, my upstairs neighbors are psychic energy vampires. And like, those were calls I didn't know what to do with, really. You know, like.
That was.
You just like, tell me more.
Put in the bag to save for a book later on.
Exactly. But also I feel like energy vampires are like the most boring kind of vampire. Like, you know, and it's funny, you know, we've all seen what's his name, the energy vampire, on What We Do in the Shadows. But like, people out there really do feel like that their neighbors are like sucking their vitality. And I don't mean what happens to Dan Aykroyd halfway through Ghostbusters with the lady ghost. But also, all the way back to the 19th century, there was a big fad for probably in the 1880s, a little bit pre-Dracula and a little bit post-Dracula, but there was a big fad for stories about energy vampires. There's some great ones. Arthur Conan Doyle wrote one. They're really great. It would just be, you know, just be people. They just get weaker and weaker and more tired. There's a great book that came out the same year as Arthur Conan Doyle's, Bram Stoker's Dracula, called Blood of the Vampire, by I cannot remember her name, but a female author. But it's basically about this young girl who's like super vivacious. And, oh my God, she just got out of like a convent. She just wants to hang out with everyone. And she goes to vacation hotspots and talks and talks and talks and talks. And everyone around her just gets like sleepier and sleepier. And then their children die. And like everyone just gets weaker. And she's just like basically like sucking their energy out. It's great.
I think I worked with her.
Yeah, it's like the manic pixie dream girl of death.
Sounds like how you come in here and on Sunset Radio, like, yeah, everything's great. And then it just sucks the life out of you. And, you know, but anyway, that's our problem. So I also, you were quite outspoken about your parents dropping you off at libraries for easy daycare. And that's you got into, that's how you got into reading. Did you naturally gravitate to the horror genre, or are you're a fan of everything from everything that I've, you know, read about you?
Yeah, horror kind of like grossed me out. You know, I was a teenager in the 80s, which is like the horror paperback boom. And really, I avoided those books. Like every kid, I discovered Stephen King at like, you know, 11. I found like Clive Barker's Books of Blood, like two of the volumes in paperback on like the shelf in a beach house we rented one summer. And those were, you know, pretty great because they had sex in them too. And then there were those, over here in the States, we had these Alfred Hitchcock Treasury. They were basically using his name to sell anthologies of horror stories. But like, it wasn't my thing. I loved military fiction and like men's adventures. Like if someone was shooting someone with a gun, like I was all about it as a kid. You know, like my favorite book in middle school was this book called The Park Is Mine by Stephen Peters, I think, and it's basically this crazy Vietnam vet just gets like, he just decides to take over Central Park, and then he booby traps it, and then for the rest of the book, cops try to take it back from him, and he just murders them. And I feel like if I was growing up now, and my favorite book that I read over and over again was about a dude murdering a whole lot of cops, and a dude who's and a dude who also not just murdering cops, but he's like totally ripped out of his head on amphetamines because he can't sleep because he's the only person holding Central Park. Like, I feel like I'd have to go see the school counselor or something. But like in the 80s, my parents were like, as long as you're reading, at least it's a book.
But I think we used to get away with a lot more back in the day, though. Like, I remember when I was a kid, because I had older brothers, so I was, like, drawing Friday the 13th comics and stuff at school. Nowadays, I'd be in the counselor's office.
Yeah.
You know?
And Jason was always fun to draw because of the hockey mask. You didn't have to worry about a human face. You got the hockey mask, a knife, you're good to go.
And I always thought it was good to just cast my classmates, because that's all I knew as a child, in these comics. So now it's probably viewed as a death threat, but, you know, they're all alive.
did they like it? Because I would imagine that kids love being killed, like in fiction.
The posh girl at school didn't. She had issues. Yeah. She made some trouble, some waves.
She'd have blown you in.
Yeah, but she got a good death, so, you know, I did her right.
Well, look, as long as you get a good death.
Yeah. I used to have friends' kids begging to kill me in my books, and I did some of them. And then I was just like, you know what? It's getting, like, my death toll with these. Like, they'd want more and bigger in the next book, and it's like, I didn't want my books to be driven solely by 8 and 9-year-olds' fantasies about dying in fiction in graphic ways, so I had to kind of stop doing it. One of them threatened to sue me. She was like,
litigious children.
She was like, we had an oral agreement that you would kill me in every single book, and you did it twice. I'm gonna get a lawyer. I was like,
wow.
See you in court, girl.
Exactly.
So we're gonna jump into, I guess, the book that kind of started it all for you in the big mainstream way was Horror Store, correct?
Yeah. I'm actually writing the screenplay right now. This is actually my little map of the inside of the store, because I'm doing the screenplay and I can't remember where anything is.
So excited about
it. Children's bedrooms.
Yeah, originally it was optioned as a TV series. Now it's going to be a feature film. Do you feel happier, sadder? How do you feel about it?
Well, it's always nice to get paid twice.
Exactly.
I imagine you can negotiate bigger points on a movie than you can on a store, on a TV.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Also, I always thought of it more as a feature film. Like, a lot of really smart people tried to crack it as a series for a few years and just couldn't do it. And I kind of felt like, well, if they can't do it, it can't be done. I mean, these were intelligent human beings with good track records. And so I think it works a lot better as a movie. I mean, it really is a dark ride at a carnival. And it's been really fun to do the screenplay. I had a moment of despair because I'm working on the second draft now, and I turned it in about a week ago. And that last week, turning that second draft around, I was just like, screw this. I can't do this. Whoever wrote this book is a piece of shit. I hate this. They're a lousy writer who can't write. And then they were really happy with it. And so I'm like, great. So I'm doing a few tweaks, and then I think we're going out to directors. So yeah, it's awesome. I am pleased with the result.
Yes. So yes, for those of you that haven't read Horror Store, it is set in a Scandinavian furniture store that just happens to be, you know, filled with ghosts. We come to learn.
And stylish and difficult to assemble furniture.
Exactly. So whose idea was the catalog?
So my editor from the beginning was like, this has to be the shape of an IKEA catalog, and it has to like have that trim size, that sort of square trim, and the cover has to look like an IKEA catalog with the sans serif font and all that. Jeffrey, did you just teleport? I just knew that there's somebody outside.
I'm so glad it took you that long to notice me. I feel so special.
I only
in
look
the
at
sticks,
myself.
We have ghetto internet.
So my editor, that was his thing. And then one of the nice things about a smaller publisher, which Quirk is I get to go back and forth with my editor and with the art director, Andy Reid. And so we would keep like, hey, what if each chapter started with a piece of furniture? And then I'd be like, well, then if we're going to do a piece of furniture, we need a piece of catalog copy. And then my editor would be like, oh, they should get sort of scarier. So it was just really nice to kick it back and forth like that. And fun fact, it's interesting. The Horror Store set up a lot of terrible expectations on my part, because IKEA is an international language. And I think that book sold to like 18 foreign territories. Like Germany paid me 5 times more than I got paid to put that book out in the States because there's so many IKEAs in Germany. And so I was like, I went to my best friend's exorcism, my next book being like, oh my God, I'm going to sell all these foreign. And I sold like 5. Because everyone knows what IKEA is, and no one in another country, no one in Thailand, they care about their good sink, you know, like wardrobes. They don't care about 2 teenage girls in 1988 South Carolina, even if one of them is possessed by Satan.
You should set it in Walmart then. It's everywhere.
I feel like IKEA is love. Like IKEA owns or occupies a really special psychic place in everyone's brain. Yes. Whereas I feel like no matter how often we go to Walmart, everyone hates
it's
Walmart.
Just, it's poor people. Nobody wants to hear about poor people in a book. Nobody cares.
Yeah, and I used to feel very different because like I come from a Walmart family. Like I have a ton of family who works in Walmarts and like they love it. And like I'm always like, do they treat you other? Oh, treat me great. And I don't see their pay stubs or anything. But it's always hard for me to thread that needle between, oh yeah, my Uncle John and my cousin Effie Lou, you know, love Walmart and have worked there for years, but you know, it's also like destroying all these small towns across the country. So Walmart's very fraught for me.
Well, so that's why you, all the more reason to make it a horror story.
Exactly.
Just walk into one.
You also said that retail was not for you. How long did you work in retail? Because you seem to nail the banality of that day-to-day as someone who works in retail and has for a long time. You nail that banality in that book. It's like,
I did. A big part of it was interviewing people who work in IKEA. Like, I mean, I must have interviewed 8 or 9 people who work in IKEAs. But I worked retail. I worked at, I had this weird moment where probably for 2 years I worked in retail. I lived in LA for a little bit, so maybe a year and a half. And I went into Tower Classical Music and they were hiring. They were next door to a Tower Video and across the street from Tower Records on Hollywood Boulevard and up towards Beverly Hills. And I went in Tower Classical because they were the only one hiring. And I had this moment because I feel like you luck out like this once in your life. And this was my one moment. And they gave me this test to take about my classical music knowledge, of which I had like 0. And I guessed. I mean, I went through and totally guessed and got every single question right. Every guess was correct. And they're like, you scored, your classical music knowledge is great. And so they brought me in and it took them about 3 months to realize my classical music knowledge was 0. And so eventually
quiz,
I just sort of
BuzzFeed. Yeah,
I just sort of oozed over into the Tower Video, which was really fun. I hated it and loved it all at the same time. I sold this was in the Laserdisc era, so I sold Pulp Friction, the porn version of Pulp Fiction on Laserdisc to Herbie Hancock. Yeah, it was great. I always get to argue because Christian Slater always ran up these outrageous late fees and then he wouldn't return his own videos and would make his housekeeper do it. And we could never accept the videos because he never gave this poor woman enough cash to pay his like $90 late fees. So I'd always have to be the one arguing with Christian Slater's housekeeper. And Carrie Fisher, weirdly, always had enormous late fees. And she always, when you pointed them out to her, like, I can't take this back until you pay the $112 you owe, she just kind of sigh, just be like, just start pulling money out of her purse. It was like, you got the feeling this happened to her a lot of places. She went just like, life was moving at one speed and she was just moving a step behind and was like, ugh.
Energy sucker.
Carrie needed a little help now and then. We all know it's okay. God rest her soul. God rest her soul. But ironically, I actually work in a music and DVD store. So I was like, I feel you. I feel you.
What do you work in? Like an HMV or?
The Australian version of HMV. Yeah.
Okay.
So still alive. At the moment, I'm in lockdown. This is like nearly month 2. So I might have a job to go back to. Who knows? This could be what kills the retail store. Yay.
One thing I never felt like I really tackled in Horror Store, and I don't really get to in the movie either, is customers, because customers are bizarre. There is something so weird about customers. I don't get it. Like, their expectations for a simple retail transaction can be like sky high. It's crazy.
I think it's, yeah, it's definitely, you're definitely becoming like everything that they want and need in this one transaction. You're like, I'm not your wife, mother, and whore. Just calm down. You're just trying to buy the latest season of Family Guy. Just drop it.
Yeah.
Drop your levels about 7 times.
One thing I thought was really interesting is IKEA actually, if you work a register at IKEA, you're usually one of their older employees, and like you've been there for a while, because their whole thing is you won't find a lot of people on the floor and you're going to get frustrated. And so the one guaranteed contact with store partners you're going to have is at the register. And so they're like, our people who run registers have to be like psychiatrists, they have to be like counselors, they have to be grief counselors, couples counseling. So like, because they just get it all just shotgun right on them by these like people who just like been walking through this store getting progressively more angry and frustrated.
And it can go the other way too, because I very much identify with your protagonist, because I'm like, people will come to the front of our store and look to see who's working behind the counter, and if I'm there they keep going. But they're usually the ones that aren't buying anything. I'm here to do a job, people. But my boss is horrific. She will listen to people all day, every day, and I'm there like unpacking stock and doing the work. I'm like, shut up, woman. Well, but they don't buy anything. They're just there to go, yes. Oh, my great aunt Susie lost a foot to diabetes in 1983. You're like, this is relevant how, but
yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I also like, really, my heart goes out to managers in retail, because they don't just have to deal with every customer. They have to deal with employees. And like, I wasn't a joy. Like, you know, we did dumb stuff. And I had to deal with the fallout.
It's good when you work there a long time, though.
In any area, though, where you're providing service to people, some people think that means, oh, you're my doormat. I'm going to wipe my feet on you.
Yeah. You have two nurses here, by the way.
So we cop it quite a lot. Like, I remember once I was doing like chronic disease care plans for people, and I was just like, everyone's telling me about how their partners have just died in the last few weeks. And I'm like, do you think this was really that important to do today if you're going through that? Like, but by the end of it, I was like, holy shit. Like, yeah, grief counseling, big time.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, actually. So wait, it's Vera and Luke who are nurses?
Nurses. Yes. Both nurses. Yep.
So my mom's was an RN for years. And I recently, so over the holidays, I drove with my nephew and I, we drove, because my mom has lung disease, so she really had to take lockdown seriously. So we drove down to South Carolina for the holidays, went down, quarantined for, you know, 7 days, got tested, spent, you know, a couple of weeks with my mom, and she got this breast cancer diagnosis on Christmas Eve. It's like, really? Like, so I was like, okay, well, I'll stick around. Yeah, I know, right? I was like, I'll stick around, you know, and be here through your mastectomy and all that stuff. She's in her 80s. And the experience in the hospital was awful. Like, it was just like the surgeon forgot to book the anesthesiologist. And like, they got point where she was in pre-op with an IV in her arm and compression sleeves on her legs, and they can't find the anesthesia. And so like, then they just like, oh, well, we'll schedule it for another day. And like, we're like, what? And it was just awful. And so I started looking around. I was like, where is a horror book set in a hospital? And except for Lars von Trier's The Kingdom, you know, the Danish TV series, I couldn't find anything. And then I saw Paddy Chayefsky's The Hospital, his movie about like a serial killer in a hospital from the 70s. And I started watching it. And I was like, oh, my God. The George C. Scott is a star, and he's like a righteous doctor. And I was like, this is a movie about the only person in a hospital who gets it is this like middle-aged white surgeon guy. I'm like, screw that. If it's not a nurse in a hospital or like a surgical resident or something, like, forget it. I don't want to hear. And so not my next book, but I think the one after that one is a horror novel set in a hospital where the hero is a nurse. Because, like, just hospitals are weird worlds,
sure Luke
man.
I'm sure Luke and I are available to consult if you need us.
I think I've
got some stories.
Dude, I love running into nurses at parties because I'm always like, you know, oh, how's work been? And man, depending on how many drinks they've had, they will go. It's the best.
Oh, I just had someone put their shit in my mouth.
Yeah. And you were into it. Don't pretend you weren't. So Horror Store is kind of like the thing that it called back for me was and not the House on Haunted Hill kind of moment of everything is definitely not what it seems, and it doesn't. You do this thing in your books where it's little by little and drip by drip that the normality of day-to-day life kind of gets infringed by whatever this supernatural force is.
Yeah.
How did you decide that horror... I know that your process is kind of like throw it all to the wall and then make it streamlined into a story. How did Horror Story come about? Because obviously we all feel that putting IKEA furniture together is a form of torture in itself.
Right.
Is this what we deserve, do you think? For wanting that perfection?
Well, you know, you actually say something really interesting because there's sort of there's a thing that's really hard to do. I mean, it's my job. Like, it's not as hard as, like, you know, someone putting their shit in my mouth. But it's where my job goes, which is, like, you know, typing away. To hit that point of no return where it's the main character, all the options are exhausted. And so what's happening is clearly horror and they now have to deal with it on that level because you can't do it all at once because that just doesn't work, you know? Like it just doesn't come across as real, but you never want the reader to get ahead of the characters in the book too far. Because then they get bored. So it's always really hard to sell that moment. And so that's really a huge challenge. With Horror Store, it was easy. I had the doors open and the ghosts come out. But it's really tough to sell that moment. And one of the nice things in Horror Store was making two of the characters ghost hunters, like from a reality, who want to be on a reality show. Because it's people who are running towards the ghosts, not away from the ghosts. And that really helps with sort of like engineering, getting to the meat of the story faster. But I mean, in my best friend's exorcism, oh my God, they got to go through so many plausible explanations for this possession before they get to a demon from hell. And so the challenge for that was making those fun. Because you just got to go through them. You know, no one's going to say my friend's possessed by Satan. That's just not going to happen right off the bat. You may feel that on the inside, but you're unlikely to take them to a deliverance minister.
Because a lot of your books have that kind of popping pop culture bubbles in, like, of their time. With Horror Store, IKEA, especially at that time, was all domination, and the ghost hunting shows were huge, you know, everyone had a ghost hunting show. So holding that up for satire and actually turning it into something that was horrifying was a really interesting way of doing it, because the ghost hunting characters are your typical ghost hunting characters in that book.
Right.
There's one that's like gung-ho, and then there's the one that wants to be famous.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what happens to them is ultimately, you know, deserved, I guess, would you say?
Well, you know, the pop culture thing's interesting because, I mean, and this sounds really lame, but I'm just trying to write about the world I see around me. And I'm always astonished at people who they're writing about, like, some world I'm not aware of. Like, and, you know, it's interesting with Stephen King's latest books. I was just reading If It Bleeds, his short story collection, at this point, I mean, King's such a rock solid writer. I mean, he's writing at a level, you know, that he really has not been in ages. And I think a lot of his recent stuff is really great. But you're reading his book about, like, high school. Like, one of the stories is about a kid in high school, and the bully is a greaser out of the 50s. And I'm like, with a glass pack muffler and wearing like, you know, pegged boots or pegged jeans. And I'm like, this is not real. This is something from your high school experience in the 50s, but it's not a kid's high school experience now. And so it's a weird thing, even with someone as good as King, who used to really get a lot of criticism for putting in brand names and his stories and things. And his whole point was, I'm writing about what I see around me. So my thing is, I'm trying to write about what I see around me. And, you know, like it or not, when you go to a party and conversation flags, people ask, what are you watching? Oh, have you seen this? Oh, you know, people talk about music. People like are talking about Instagram. It's like people are really tied into pop culture. And that's a big, we live in that sort of ecosystem. And so I kind of have to put it in the books or else it just doesn't work. You know, I'm working on my book for next year right now and I'm very late with it. And, you know, one of the things I just realized is like, there is no social media mention in it. And one of the characters obviously wouldn't, but the other one would have Instagram. She just would. And like, I'm just like I've got to come up with some kind of explanation for that. Otherwise it just doesn't, you know, ring true. And social media has nothing to do with the story. What's that?
Or get her an Instagram account.
Yeah, I know, but it's like, it doesn't have anything to do with the book. And, you know, it's just like, but I got to navigate it because otherwise it just, she doesn't feel like a normal human in 2021. Yeah.
Exactly. So before we move away from Horror Store, because we know that there's a movie coming and I'm super excited about it, I'm going to jump to the ending without too much, without trying to spoil it too much. I mean, if you haven't read it yet, hurry up and read it. Like, it's only been out for a couple of years. Yeah, come on, guys. Planet Baby. What do you think? Is there a potential there for more story? I can imagine some kind of demonic, like, Village of the Damned Children of the Corn moment.
If there is more story there, it's not going to come from me. And there definitely could be. But yeah, I'm not a sequel guy. Like, exactly. I've got six, seven books I want to write that I know I want to write next. And you know, one of the things I'm always jealous of, because I don't really love some series, but you look at a lot of writers and like their series is their thing, you know, Lee Child with the Jack Reacher books, Patricia Cornwell's Kay Scarpetta books, Elmore Leonard had characters he returned to over and over again. Neil Gaiman and Sandman, you know, you look at this stuff and you really, even Stephen King has some characters he returned in The Dark Tower. So I really wish I had characters that like had more than one book in them. I really wish I had an idea that could spread over several. I just don't. That's just not where I am. And I hope I do one day because they make you rich. But I just don't.
Well, if the well runs dry, you know where to go back to. You know what I mean? The well run things go, what was popular? But you were talking about writing from your experience. I think you really nailed, well, for I was not really a teenager in the 80s, but you nailed that 80s vibe in your book, My Best Friend's Exorcism. I love the cover to start with. Like, hello.
Hugh Fleming, I think, an Australian artist did that. He's done a lot of Star Wars art. And we weren't supposed to have that cover. Doogie Horner was the art director at Quirk, my publisher. And he came on board about 6 weeks before we needed the paperback cover. And he had this idea to do a VHS tape. And they were like, we don't have time. We got 6 weeks. We're going to go with the hardback cover for the paperback. And Doogie's like, nope. And he found Hugh. And Hugh was like, there's not much time. I will give you one sketch. You can give me one set of notes, the end. I'll give you a finished piece after that, the end. And he gave us a sketch, and it was pretty sweet. And so we gave him a few notes, and then he turned that in. And it was like, that cover has sold a lot of books for me. Yeah. And we should not have done it. That was entirely Doogie's intestinal fortitude and Hugh's talent.
But I think the reason that it appeals to people is we've been to the video store, we know what that is. That's the known quantity. And you including the Cosmo-y quiz things and the song titles as chapter headings and all that kind of thing. really let us sit in that world of, you know, this is our moment, and these are what these kids are going through. But the friendship, like for a horror book, you know, it gets thrown around a lot that horror is a disposable genre. There's a lot of heart in this one as well. Like the characters, I really got into this one. I was like, oh my God, this was one that was a 4 a.m. one. I was like, okay, one more chapter. I'm like, okay, it's 4:30. I'm done. I was like, yay, I survived. But you feel like you really do go through it with them, which is something that a lot of writers can't catch. You get that feeling that, you know, as we talked about before, something's not right. And you're like, oh, is it demonic, or is she just, you know, losing her mind slowly bit by bit? But
yeah,
the white worm scene, like there's always there's one or two scenes in your novels that you go, oh, okay, this feel like that one felt like full-on Freddy Krueger moment. Like,
yeah, like, well, oh. I was surprised because I hadn't seen that scare before. And I think we've all heard the sort of urban legend, you know, of how do you get rid of a tapeworm? You wave a piece of raw meat in front of someone's nose and it'll come out because it's hungry. And then, you know, I clearly wasn't raised in a good home because I threw in a dog going after it. But dogs do that kind of stuff. And one of the reasons I think that book worked, and it was the first time I did this, but I really... there were people who really got me through high school. I mean, friends of mine really, I would not have made it without them. And so I really wanted to write about those high school friendships because they burn so hot and so passionate. And then after graduation, we often don't see those people again, or if we do, it doesn't feel right. It's yep. awkward. And those friendships are there when we need them, and they mean a lot. And I had ones that really meant a lot. And so I really wanted to write about that. And I'm glad it comes across. One of the things that really bums me out that I see writers doing, and I see myself doing, is not taking the time to really unpack something. Like, there were probably several, I don't even want to give a number, but several versions of my best friend's exorcism that had a lot more plot, a lot more incident, a lot more big scares. But what I realized is I was shortchanging the emotional moments. And those are what really pull people in. And so taking the time to unpack those really mattered. And like the book I'm doing right now is about a pair of siblings, and I've never written siblings before. And I was just doing a pass on the manuscript, just sort of go through and do a hand pass, because I always print it out after the first draft, and it's different when you read it on paper. And I was like, oh God, you know, there's a long time with just emotional stuff between this brother and sister. Like, I don't know. And then I got to the big first scare sequence, and I was like, okay. That I'm not a total idiot. Like, got it.
The payoff
that leads up to this, yeah. And like, and so, and I'm going to tighten it up some, but it's just like having those emotions in there. The payoffs don't have to be as over the top, because they'll hit stronger. So I just think I just think taking the time to unpack that stuff, and even in this book, I need to unpack some stuff that I'm skimping on. So it's the hardest thing to make yourself do, because you're like, hey, this book's a B+. I'm good with the B+. Like, you're looking at a guy who skated through high school on C's. I'm like, I'm good. And it's like, no, sit down, do the work, you know, take the time, do it over.
Mm-hmm. So. Because, as you were saying, it does capture that it does capture that desperation of teenage friendship, because you do feel like that limited space in time that, and I don't think you really comprehend that until later on. That, you know, these relationships are burned so bright and so intensely, and then sometimes you don't see these people ever again, but yeah, they leave such an indelible mark on who you are as a person. The ending is, for a horror book, it's a beautiful, it's kind of tragic, I guess.
But well, it's life, right? Like,
it's life. That's exactly it. Like, one of the lines is, they didn't make it to Halley's Comet, but they tried. And I feel like that's all we can really do as humans and as a friend. Like, you're not always going to be the most perfect friend to somebody, but as long as you're willing to pull them through the big things and the small things, that's what really counts at the end. And that's what I got from the end of that book. And I sat there and just kind of went, oh, and like had a little, you know, exhale moment of going, oh, okay, that's, if it kind of gives you validation as a friend to go, because we all judge ourselves quite harshly, like, am I being a good friend? We get caught up in our own things, but it's, yeah, I was like, okay, that's how I feel. Like, if I'm there for you when you need me. Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And you obviously like to get into the worlds you create, because explain them. Explain this moment.
Okay. Wow. About this.
That is from the book launch party for my best friend's exorcism. So I had a thing. So when I did Horror Store, I really didn't know what I was doing, right? Because a big part of like writing books is then getting on the road and selling them. So I would go out and I did this book launch event. And it was like a 3-hour drive from New York in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania. And the publicist was like, no, it's a great store. It's a great store. And it was a good store. And I get there and there's like 30 chairs set up and there's like one person in the chair. And I was like,
Come on.
And so I said, you know what? Adapt, adopt, and improve. So I went over and I said, hey, I'm Grady. I'm so glad you came out. You know, I'm not going to stand up and give a big speech because, you know, it's just you. So let's talk, like, just let's rap, man. Just like people. And she said, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry. I'm just waiting for my friend to come out of the bathroom.
Oh,
and she put it out of there. And the store manager was so embarrassed there was no one there that he made the staff, all four of them, sit and listen to my spiel. And the problem was the register was right behind me. So when someone was like coming up to buy something, they'd have to get up and go. Yeah. And I vowed then, like Scarlett O'Hara and Gone with the Wind, like, I'll never eat beets again. And so when I did my best friend's exorcism, I was like, you know what? I'm putting on a costume. I'm doing a thing. I don't know what it is. So I went out and I had this shtick worked up. It was okay. It wasn't great. It was okay. And then after that came Paperbacks from Hell. And I was like, I'm doing a show. And so with Paperbacks from Hell, I did this 55-minute show with songs in it. And it's about 55 to 60 minutes, depending on if people laugh or not. And it's got something like 118 slides. So it moves. And people loved it. And I would get libraries that like would host it in bars to do it. People get drunk, have a great time.
Yes.
And so I've done that with every single one of my books. I just got back from a drive-in this weekend doing the the Final Girl Support Group show. And I find it so much fun to do that and so unfun to do a book reading and a Q&A. And so that's just something I do. And I think, you know, look, people have come out. They've been hurt by author events before. If you give them a doll, they can show you where the author touched them in a bad place. And
I wouldn't be mad about that. I don't see the problem.
I don't know if you've seen authors. They're not all as pretty as this. But full circle. But I feel like if people have come out and gotten a sitter and hauled their ass to a bookstore, I deserve to give them a good time. Like, you know, I will make sure they can relax and know that I'm the biggest idiot in the room. I'm going to give them like something they don't know or haven't heard before, and they're going to have fun. And if they don't have fun, they're free drinks. You know, I just like, that's the bargain, I feel like.
Exactly. And the movie is finished shooting yet? Still?
It's in, I think it's in post-production or like in like, you know, post-production. Like it's done. I haven't
It's coming.
It. Yeah.
Are you anticipating sitting down and watching that unfold, or are you the kind of person that's going to go, oh, don't want to watch it? That answers my question, right?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I've written a couple of screenplays. I mean, I've written a lot of screenplays, but a couple of screenplays that I've written have been produced. This movie called Mohawk and a movie called Satanic Panic. And in both cases, the director had to be like, you need to sit down and watch the movie now. And I'd be like, oh man, come on, don't make me do it. And I'm glad they did. I've sat it with an audience both times and seen them once with an audience. And it's enormously educational to hear your dialogue coming out. I mean, it's really like 4 years of film school in each of those screenings. But I'm only doing it once. Like, I don't reread my old books, like, except for We Sold Our Souls. I don't reread my old books. Like, I just keep moving forward like a shark. And like, not a cool shark, like an idiot shark.
Did you come up with the Drildo? I have to know. Was the Drildo your...
So the Drildo was an amazing life lesson for me. So when I wrote that script, the Kildo was a big deal in the script. It was our litmus test. Producers would get it and be like, that's the greatest thing I've ever seen. We've got to make this movie. And other producers would get it and be like, so this sexual appliance. And so you really, you know, we had versions with it and without it, all this stuff. And in the movie itself, it doesn't work. On the page, it is amazing when people get it. In the movie, it doesn't work. And it doesn't work for a couple of reasons. It's not the fault of the filmmakers. It doesn't work because I didn't give it enough buildup. I didn't give it enough oomph. I didn't give it enough. And I didn't utilize it the right way. And ultimately, it's a sight gag. And unless you're doing like a Naked Gun movie or like, you know, something like that, sight gags don't work. And what I realized watching Satanic Panic with an audience is where the audience leans in is where there are two characters on screen talking, set pieces, gore effects, sight gags. People are like, yeah, okay. When it's two characters interacting, especially if they're in opposition, and the more in opposition you can put them, the better. But that's when people lean in. And so that was a huge lesson for me. And it's something I don't think a lot of people who produce movies really respect. And I think it's something writers really respect. And I think that leads to a lot of tension that isn't always bad, but a lot of tension between producers who want big, sellable, fun stuff on the page and writers who are like, no, this is where people will pay attention when these two characters are arguing. But that was a huge lesson for me.
So Grady, are you saying that's what made Pulp Friction a good film?
There are scenes in Pulp Friction that are so moving as these characters interact. No, I don't think that's such a big thing in Pulp Friction, but the other porn movie Herbie Hancock was buying, Bubble Butt Bongo 4, I feel like it's the best of the Bubble Butt Bongo series because it has the most interaction. Agree. Not just sight
gags.
It's my favorite.
So you brought up We Sold Our Souls before.
Yes.
We Sold Our Souls. I loved this book.
Thank you.
And like, really, like, have you been in a band?
No.
Grady?
But I know you have been.
Oh, you've done your research there, because when it's first going back to Chris talking about the evolution of a gig and you sitting there and go, oh, well, not sitting there, but you're behind the microphone or behind your instrument and going, these people could care less if I just like burst into flames. And then they tap their feet and then they stop, they listen. And then by like, you capture that so well.
Oh, thank you.
Was that an interview kind of process
So, I went to university in New York. So, during the Riot Girl kind of boom. So everyone I knew was in a band and I had to go to all their shows. And so I had to lug equipment and amps and load the van and unload the van and sit in their dorm rooms or their apartments getting stoned with them while they talk endless tour logistics. That was part of it. And then metalheads are great. And so I was able to interview so many people in metal bands and stuff at that sort of level. And then I actually, I'm not very musical, but I took guitar lessons for about 3 months just to sort of get the feel of what that's like to actually play it. And I can play the hell out of Zombie by the Cranberries and Smoke on the Water. Like, I'm primo on those at electric guitar.
Work it out.
That's about it. I just did a lot of research and but I'm glad it worked because that book really means a lot to me. That book really, writing that book got me through a really tough time in my life. And so when someone, and it's my lowest selling book. Because as my agent says, every writer wants to write a rock and roll book, and it's the job of every agent to stop them. I mean, George R. R. Martin wrote a rock and roll book, and it wrecked his writing career, and then he got into TV and then did Game of Thrones. Like, it will, I mean, you know, it will trash your career. And actually, you know, I was pretty toxic after we sold our souls because of the sales numbers. And so, but I really, that book means a lot to me personally.
You can tell it's a very, again, cathartic book. You can tell for anyone that's, I think, chased a dream or had a taste of something that they really love and then has to go back to the, you know, the normal world, the people that are artistic, that are creative, that have passion. You feel that in this as well. Like, you go, what it's like to stand behind a counter and have to deal with assholes when all you really want to do is the thing that makes your heart beat a little bit faster. And that journey is definitely there in that book. I think I gravitated to this most, actually.
Oh, thank you. No, yeah. I really appreciate it. It's also, you know, one of the things for me is when I wrote that book, I was really, like, every single one of my books has, like, a question in it that isn't clear for the reader, but for me, it's sort of what pulls me through the book. And for We Sold Our Souls, it was like, when do I quit? Like, I was still taking freelance gigs at that point. I wasn't getting a lot of traction. I mean, Best Friends, Extras did well. Hey, Rocks Held It Well. I mean, I had a small career, but I was 44, 45 when I wrote that. It's like, when do I stop? When do I like? When is this? When do I get over the line? And and that was really what Chris in the book is sort of dealing with. And so that book was sort of my way of being like, what am I doing here? What am I doing with my life?
Exactly. Like, and the end of that story is so, it's so fitting as well, because Chris, depending on how you read the book, Chris disappears into the mythology that she creates as well. So ultimately the artist is like incidental in it with the art that they create. She becomes this legend because she created a legend, and then the effects of the book kind of bleed out into the rest of the world. And it's not a happy ending, but it's a hopeful one.
I really appreciate that. You know, one place that book came from is, so when I was a kid, I've got three older sisters, and one of them was living in Philly, and she managed bands, and she was managing, and they were small bands, and she was managing like club bands, and she was managing a band called the 10th House. And I thought, and I had their demo tape, and I thought they were pretty great. No one else did. They would play like outdoor gigs and bars and stuff, you know.
For five people, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought they were a really great band. And there was something about that personal connection with my sister. And so I was a pretty terrible student in high school. And I had their demo tape with three songs on it. And I, some mornings listening to that on the drive to school, when I drive my Volkswagen van into school, was like, just the drive was just long enough to listen to that demo once. And that, a lot of mornings in 10th grade and 11th grade, that demo is what got me to school. It meant everything to me. And around then, like, the band broke up, they drifted off. I'm sure most of them have straight jobs now. And to them, I'm sure they look back on the time when they're the bands. I'm sure some of them regard it as a giant failure. I'm sure some of them regard it as, oh, that was a fun phase. You know, others, but they changed my life with that demo. Yeah. They got me through a really rough period. And, you know, I feel like that's what doing art is. And you sort of just put messages in a bottle and you just throw them in the ocean. And you hope they wash up on beaches, on islands where people open them up and are like, this is the map I need. And you may never know. You're never probably going to know what they reach or who they get to. But that's what you do, because you can't do anything else. And it does matter, because even if it's just like a 15-year-old kid in South Carolina, it gets to someone who needs it. You just have to trust that, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. I love. Yeah, I'm like, oh yeah, I get that. I feel you. I feel you. I feel you. As a performer, I'm like, That's all you really want as someone who creates. That's all you want. But I think you feel the effect from this book, right? The Southern Book Club's Guide to Vampires, Slaying Vampires. This one seems to have like connected like no one's business, right?
It did. I mean, it was my first book to hit the New York Times bestseller list, which really does change your value in the marketplace substantially. One of the things with this book is it's a book I wanted to write probably since Horror Store, since around there. And I was always worried that I wasn't good enough to pull it off because it meant a lot to me. And also, I got a lot of pushback from my publisher for reasons that I get, you know. They were kind of like, you know, this is a book about middle-aged women and our marketing department doesn't know how to reach that audience. And like, you know, we do pop culture books, like and I get it, you know, and you only want to write a book. One of the lessons I've learned is you only want to write a book your publisher wants to sell. And I've seen writers not do that and really pay the price. I've not done that before and paid the price. But with this book, I was like, dudes, this will, I really believe it. And then in the middle of doing it, they were like, I don't know, man, the main characters are these older women. It's about vampires and the salespeople really think vampires are oversaturated. And so that was actually very lucky for me because I really like opposition. I really like being like, I'll show you. And because this book was so high stakes for me, I really wanted it to work and sort of, you know, really, really sweated it out. And I lost my editor who I had from the beginning. He moved on somewhere else during the beginning of this book. And I changed editors twice after. It was tough. And, but I really, I had a really strong feeling. Like, this book doesn't work. Like I'm doing something very wrong. Like it doesn't have book club in the title by accident. I was like, book clubs will read this. Book clubs like books with book club in the title. Like the book clubs are always looking for new books, and this is a book about a book club. Like it's yeah. I feel like there's a market out there. So that one was really sort of the moonshot. Like it was right after we sold our souls, and it's like it was my last book on contract with Quirk, and I was kind of like it was my go for broke.
Yeah, I think that oversaturation. That vampire oversaturation works in its favor because everyone's like, oh, vampires, right? But that's the whole reason it works. And you capture the bloodthirsty nature of the, you know, proper Southern woman so well.
I'm very new to the Gradyverse here.
Oh, welcome.
Steve, thank you. Steve's like, oh, this author's going to come on the show. You gotta get on board. I'm like, all right. So I'm cruising through Amazon. I'm like, well, 2020 bestseller, that seems like a pretty good place to start. And like by the second paragraph, I was hooked. And I just came Tuesday and I haven't finished it. I'm only halfway through, but it's like everything keeps pulling me forward. I'm like, I love it.
I'm so glad. Like that's also a book where like, there were two radically different versions of that book before I sort of wrote the draft of what became the right book. And it went through so many changes. I mean, there was a whole version where they just read normal books like Madame Bovary and stuff like that. And then I was like, they should be reading true crime. Like, because no one takes true crime seriously. So it's one more reason to dismiss them. So I had to read a bunch of true crime while writing it to sort of like, what books are they reading? And which was actually really eye-opening. I'm glad I got a chance to do that.
Well, I know I'm going to massacre this, but one of those moments that just grabbed me, and I was like, oh, I love this writer, you know, was when you're talking about how people look down on popular fiction, you know, and that conversation between Patricia and Kitty, I think it is, you know, it seems like it's popular for a reason, you know, and I just like, yes, yes.
No, exactly. Well, you know, and I grew up with my mom's book club and then other book clubs around. And like that is something they really wrestle with, because when you put together your reading list, you're sort of presenting yourself to the world. And I think now genre fiction gets more respect. I think sort of post Harry Potter and Game of Thrones, it gets more, and Twilight, it gets more respect. But I think for a long time, like, you know, you read John, like reading The Handmaid's Tale was seen as going out on a limb. You know, well, that's science fiction. What are you doing, book club?
Like, and, that's so science fiction at the moment.
And I also grew up watching women apologize for what they were reading, which is something I see happens a lot. And I don't see it happen with guys as much. But I see it happen with women a lot, especially if they read romance or mysteries, or, I mean, I can't tell you the number of times one of my sisters has said, oh, it's just a dumb blank. And I ask what they're reading. And it's really interesting to me.
Well,
I'm not going to put too many spoilers in there because Vera's going to keep reading, and I don't want to spoil any part of the book for her.
I come from an English literature background. That's what my bachelor's degree was in. Long before I planned to go into nursing, I was going to be a journalist. I was going to write novels. I was going to take the path that you took. But then it's like, oh, I hate deadlines. Oh, I don't want to cover another damn play. Oh, I don't care about that benefit. That's just like, I got out of news for good and stumbled into nursing. But I love the way you observe the world. And, you know, I don't read to be edified. I read Chaucer. I've read Shakespeare. I've read all the great works because I have a bachelor's degree in great works. I read for fun, and your book is so much fun.
Okay.
I was like, I got a friend I'm going to buy. We sold our souls for Christmas. I got another friend.
Like, oh, I really appreciate. No, listen, you're paying my mortgage, so thank you.
So with that, yeah, we're gonna have to move on from that one because I don't want to spoil it because that it turns so beautifully and it plays out like one of those old, like it. It's kind of like sudden Hitchcock, that slow burn realization that the evil is actually in suburbia, like Shadow of a Doubt kind of thing, where it's like, oh, things aren't right, and they're really not right by the end of it. My favorite, I've got to put it out there, favorite character in the whole book is Mrs. Green, and
oh yeah,
she's written. I'm so glad that you love her as well, because you can tell. Like she's part of that group, but she is so other from that group, and it says so much about the station of women and the station of, you know, non-white women, and especially in the South and in the 90s. But I can talk about this for ages. We're gonna have to keep going. Amazon, huge deal. Yeah?
Yeah. Well, actually, it's interesting. So Southern Book Club is going somewhere else for TV series. Amazon passed on it.
Okay.
So, no, we're going somewhere else. We're negotiating right now. But the thing that's nice about this turning into a TV series is what you were just saying about Ms. Green. Every showrunner we've talked to really wants to expand Ms. Green's role in the book. And I'm like, you go. Like, you know what I mean? The book is a finite amount of time. A TV season is a lot longer. So that's one thing I'm really, really excited about is doing more Ms. Green.
Oh, definitely. She deserves it. She's amazing. And if you, I admit that you don't like to cast your own stuff, but my dream, Mrs. Green, and this is who I pictured as soon as she came on, and I don't know how we make it happen, but I'm going to put it into the universe. Viola Davis.
Oh, sure.
Mrs. Green, come on. That's it.
In a heartbeat.
I'm like, Viola, that she, like, especially with everything she did on How to Get Away with Murder, I'm like, channel that into this. Ugh.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, I got a bit passionate about that. We can't let you go. We've been talking for an hour already, but we can't let you go without talking about your newest baby. And I'm sure you're sick of talking about her, but she is amazing. Final Girl Support Group, Grady Hendrix. This we are a very horror-friendly podcast. We actually do a little horror spin-off called Uncensored Horror. We've interviewed Lisa Wilcox from Friday the 13th. Like, oh, Nightmare on Elm Street 4 and 5. We are all about the horror, and we nailed this sucker. Yeah. I'll forward you the interview.
Alice Johnson is my favorite final girl. I love Alice. So underrated.
Right. I'll forward you the interview so you can have a look at her.
Yeah,
please. And Lisa in real life is a trip, man. She's everything you wanted to be. She's so humble, so nice. So whoever's casting, call Lisa Wilcox. She's good. She's good to go for the movie. But, yeah, talk to us about Final Girls because obviously you have an appreciation for 80s and 90s
slashes. Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. There's two moments that this book comes from, and one is reading an issue of Fangoria number 12, April of 81, which is a feature on the opening of Friday the 13th part 2, where Alice Hardy, played by Adrienne King, who's the final girl from part 1, is just sort of having a normal night at home, and all of a sudden Jason kills her. And that really blew me away. I was like 8 years old when I read that, and I was like, what? Like, all this terrible stuff happened to her. She had to decapitate Ms. Voorhees, and they just knock her off like this at the beginning. And I was like, that's terrible. Like, this is, no, that's wrong. And then a few years later, in 87, I think, I saw Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. And in the middle of it, Heather Langenkamp, Nancy Thompson, who's the final girl from part 1, shows up leading a group therapy session for kids who are being terrorized by Freddy in part 3. And I was like, oh my God. These people can move between movies and like help each other. And that sort of, those two things sort of stuck in my mind until 2013, when I was talking to a friend of mine and I came up with the title Final Girl Support Group. And I was like, that's the whole book right there. And I mean, I had done that. I had only been that lucky before with My Best Friend's Exorcism, where I had the title first and was like, that's the book. And so from then it was just a matter of unpacking that. Right. And sort of really, really taking these final girls, not just using them as these horror movie icons, but really taking them seriously as people and sort of, what does this do to you? What happens here? What is that like to watch all your friends get killed when you're in high school? And then you live under that shadow for the rest of your life. Like, and your trauma gets turned into popcorn entertainment for everyone else. Like, these things that happen to you are fun for other people. Like, so it was just really... I was really lucky, you know. I mean, there's been Final Girl stuff before, and I really was determined to really take these people seriously as human beings, and really try to respect them that way. And I mean, also, it's fun. I hope
it is. Oh, look, when I first started to read it, I actually got the narration by Adrienne King.
Oh, she's so good.
And I was
amazing voice actor. I had no idea. And then by the, because I listened to it on audiobook as well. I was like, what? Why are you so great, Adrienne King? Sorry, Luke.
No, you're right. No, I just wasn't sure what I was getting into. I was like, well, what is this? Like, is this like just about the trope of the final girl? Like, and then as it's starting to unpack, it's like, wow. And I think you really write women well. I think you really do.
I really
like, you
appreciate
get.
That.
Yeah, I just think it was just, it's so interesting. Like, I haven't finished yet, and I have to, like, be careful now because when I'm playing, because I've been playing it in the car, but I've got a four-year-old in the back. Normally we play, like, Beauty and the Beast or Nemo, and so she's like, oh, what's going to happen to Adrienne now, Dad? I'm like, okay,
oh my God,
you can stop listening.
That's amazing.
You can stop listening.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's funny, there were two things that were really... How far are you in the book?
I'm about halfway.
Okay, then I'll say there's one thing, there's two things that are really important to me, but one doesn't come up until later. But one of the things that's really important to me is, you know, there's a big difference between final girls and that kind of female warrior character in movies now and the final girls we got in sort of the early slasher boom of like 78 to 84. And when you get these women now in movies, they show up ready to rumble, man. They are like Furiosa in Fury Road. And I love that movie. I have nothing against it. But they show up like with all these weapon skills and they're fighters and they're tough and they're all these things. But the final girls I really grew up on were like big sisters, and they weren't particularly strong, and they didn't particularly fight well, and they weren't sort of weaponized and ready to rumble. They weren't often even the smartest person in the room, but they just didn't quit, and they just refused to give up, and they had this real resiliency. That doesn't work, I'll do this. That doesn't work, I'll do this. You know, Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween, I'm trapped in a closet. What can I, okay, a coat hanger. I'll use anything. And that's what I really got. And so it was really important to me that whenever Lynette tries to do something tough, like to fight someone or pull a gun or something, she either loses or makes it worse. Like, you know, it's
exactly.
Like, it's like, it was really important to me that all her planning just sort of like not be worth it. And that she had to rely on sort of whether or not she can do this. And
I think that was always what was so interesting about the final girls back in, you know, definitely in 80s, 90s slashes, was that sort of change from when they become like the victim to they almost are mirroring the killer by the end.
Yeah.
You know, they're coming at them with that same aggression, that same violence. And that's usually like that's when they were the one who succeeds, because they're meeting what's like they're meeting the challenge, I guess. They're coming back and it's, whereas if they're starting the film already in warrior mode, there's no real growth there, is there? And there's no real rise to...
Exactly. And it's like, I love Buffy. Like, I think, you know, my sisters worship Buffy. I can't...
Hold up 1 second, Grady. Guess what Luke's daughter's name is?
Her name is Buffy.
Oh,
and she's very much a Buffy. She was trying to beat my 29-year-old sister up the other night. She's poor. And I'm like, stop it. I'm like, do you want to come and do some coloring? And she turns to me and she's like, yes, I do, but let me finish her off.
Well, I have to jump in really
get
quickly.
It, girl.
I haven't read Final Girl, but I'm picking up the gist of it. And having grown up in the 80s, the Final Girl was a pretty crucial step in the evolution of female heroes.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. And you know, Buffy, as much as I love her, Buffy is a warrior from the word go. You know, she is ready to throw down. And, you know, and so they have to find ways to make her vulnerable and focus on the people around her and all that. And I think they do it amazingly well. But like the earlier Final Girls, like you were saying, Luke, they have to sort of fumble their way forward to getting there. You know, they aren't that to begin with. And I wanted these women to be that, you know?
I always say, like, Chris Higgins is one of my favorite Final Girls because she's almost so unstable and hysterical to begin with.
Yeah.
And, like, by the end, though, like, she's a beast. Like, she's really fighting Jason. And
Amy Steele enjoyed that. Amy Steele, Ginny Fields, Friday the 13th, part 2 for the win. So I just want to, before we, I'm not going to spoil this one too much because there is a big twist, and you do make the differentiation between a survivor and a final girl, which Lynette starts out as one and kind of graduates through. But there's a really interesting quote that Adrian has in the book where she says, "No one's too far gone to be brought back and no one is too lost to be found." Is that a general vibe? Like these girls have horrible, or women, not girls, let's, you know, kind of segregate them further, have horrible things happen to them, and yet they somehow manage to move forward. Even even the most scarred of them, so I think like Danny and characters like that, they find a way to move forward. Do you think that's a message of hope, I guess, that even any trauma is you can come through trauma?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing you'll see in my books over and over again, it's the end of my best friend's exorcism, it's We Sold Our Souls, it's Final Girls, is the moment you're done is when you stop trying. And I've seen people in my life who really have a tough time and they keep trying. And their trying isn't always successful, and sometimes it's ugly, and sometimes it's messy, but they're alive. Because I know people who've stopped trying, and they aren't alive in the same way. And I feel like that's really the only cardinal sin you can commit in your life, is to give up. You know, when my parents got divorced, my mom was in her 50s. And she got married in 1958. She had a high school diploma. She'd been a nurse, but she gave up nursing to be a mom. And my parents were married for 34 years or something. And when they got divorced, she didn't have a credit score because she'd never had a bank account or a credit card in her name. And she really struggled. And you know, went back to school, graduated college, got her nursing certificate, renewed, and went on to have a really rich, full life after her 50s. But I would say from 51 to 58 or 59 was pretty bleak for her. And I think that's part of where it comes from for me, is seeing her really in a position where she could have just stopped. You know, she really, no one would have blamed her. And she didn't have that choice. And, you know, I was still a kid. My sisters were all off. I'm much younger. But she didn't have that choice. And so I always feel like giving up is the only thing you can do wrong. Everything else doesn't matter, as long as you're trying.
I love that message. And look, we have been going for over an hour now, and I said I would only bother you for an hour. I have so many questions, but Grady, you've been so gracious with your time. You've got a non-fiction book coming out, though. These Fists Break Bricks. That's hard to say.
Yeah, I know. I like long titles that are hard to remember and say. Yeah, it's coming out. It's coming out a little later than we thought because international shipping's all messed up. It's in a container in the Pacific somewhere. We know that much.
Oh, lovely.
But it can be pre-ordered now. And it's a big, it's like Paperbacks from Hell, but it's for Kung Fu movies. And it's the history of Kung Fu movies coming to America in the 70s. And I work with this friend of mine, Chris Bajali, and we've got so much amazing art in it, so many movie posters, so many ads, things people have never seen before. And we really operated from this principle of, you can't say that Kung Fu movies became popular in America in 1973. There was a first one, and there was a first screening, and we were going to find the people who were there. And man, the stories we dug up, Chris and I, everything from the CIA sponsoring karate movies, secretly producing karate movies to try to root out communists, to an 11-year-old kid who made an international blockbuster film, to the New York Times completely fabricating a series of stories about a black karate gang that was out to kill white people and starting a whole basically race riot in New York City. Like, we dug up so much amazing stuff. We interviewed people who passed away since we interviewed them. We're both really proud of this book. I really hope people read it. But if you want to pre-order it or something, you can find a link to it and everything on my site starting tomorrow, GradyHendrix.com, or actually it's there now, but GradyHendrix.com, and pre-order it, get it, worship it, do what it says. Even if it says kill your neighbors, just do it. The book's always right.
The book is always right. The book is always right. And of course, you've got lots of stuff coming down the pipe in visual media as well. You've hinted that there's lots more coming book wise. Can you give us any little dribbles of what's coming next in fiction?
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on a book right now that I'm a little late on, but it's a novel, and it's set during the pandemic because I really got sick of writers. I did this like sort of conversation with Chuck Palahniuk, who wrote Fight Club, and he's a writer who has had an enormous influence on me. I just like, you know, some of the stuff he does is really smart. But I asked him if he was working on anything. This was like in August, I think, of last year. And he was like, oh, yeah, I'm working on a book. And I was like, is it contemporary? And he's like, yeah. I said, so how are you dealing with the pandemic? And he's like, yeah, I try not to include trends in my book. And I was like, I don't think this is a trend.
Like, this is life, buddy.
It's a little bigger than that.
Oh, my God,
that.
Yeah.
And so I really, and I lost a lot of people last year. I lost about 5 people last year. And I feel like one of the jobs of a horror writer is to sort of remind people that not everything's buried. And I feel like there's this real urge to sort of take 2019 and take 2022 and just cut out everything between and just join those up and pretend it didn't happen. And so it's a book that's set during the pandemic, and it's about parents and brothers and sisters and evil puppets.
Sounds it'll be amazing. Out in 2022. We are ready for it. If you have not checked out a Grady Hendrix novel, folks, do yourself a favor. It doesn't matter where you start. They are all gold. So read a title, read a description. Grady would love if you bought everything, obviously. because twice. You know,
twice
audiobook, ebook, physical, you know, frame it on the wall. Grady Hendrix, thank you so much for joining us today. You've been an absolute pleasure, as you promised you would be. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank you guys for teaching me a very, very valuable lesson. That if I ever have a child and it's 10 years old and I have to discipline it, don't. Because clearly Jeffrey's child murdered him halfway through this.
No, it's Jeffrey's internet that murdered him. So that's what they say. We have to do a live show very soon. So if Jeffrey's not here, we'll contact the authorities.
Between Buffy and Jeffrey's kid, I fear children a lot right now.
Yes.
They're terrifying. They are.
They are terrifying.
They ruin lives. You know.